This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off. The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. As the coalition government enters its final chapter, George Osborne delivered a pre-election budget.
This is a budget that takes Britain one more big step on the road from austerity to prosperity. We have a plan that is working, and this budget works for you.
There was a rise in the tax allowance. There was money off beer, petrol and whisky, and an eye-catching measure to help first-time homebuyers fund a deposit. It was a Chancellor who seems to have finally found his voice at the dispatch box, and he was in good humour.
The Battle of Agincourt is, of course, celebrated by Shakespeare as a victory secured by a band of brothers, which is sadly not an option available to the party opposite.
Well, after the statement, we dropped in on The Guardian's economics editor, Larry Elliott, who was talking it all through with our opinion editor, Jonathan Friedland.
So we've just heard George Osborne's budget. I mean, we knew he was going to do a pre-election budget, but it wasn't all the usual stuff you get with giveaways and gimmicks, that was his phrase, but it was a bit different, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a clever pre-election budget without there being any net giveaway. I mean, that's what was smart about it. And he kept to his overall theme, which is deficit reduction, debt reduction, but he still found some money.
Money down the sofa.
Money to hit some very, very important constituencies for him. So, you know, he raised money from parts of the economy which, you know, no one really noticed very much, banks and, you know, rich pensioners and tax avoidance, and he gave it away in very, very obvious ways. Beer and whiskey and, you know, the new help for home buyers.
I mean, this was the right to buy ISA.
Yeah,
that's going to get a lot of attention.
That will get a lot of attention. It is in a way, it's a very, very clever but fraught with difficulties proposal, really, because it's going to add to demand for housing without doing anything about actually building any new homes.
And the thing we always say about Osborne is he is so political. I mean, he is both the Chancellor of the Exchequer in charge of the country's finances and the election supremo for the Conservatives, and you saw that all the way through this. Each one of the things he announced, it wasn't necessarily it was good for the economy, it was a blocking an attack line from Labour. So Labour say, you know, you're the party of the rich. So he says, actually, the 1% are paying more tax than ever. Yeah. We're going to do this for middle earners. You know, you're the party of the London metropolitan elite. So he comes up with Northern Powerhouse and all the other stuff for the regions of the country.
Yeah.
He's thinking politically all the time.
I mean, the top 1% pay most of the tax. You know, we've reduced the numbers of people in child poverty. We've, you know, the number of young unemployed is down. So he was very, very keen to show that he wasn't the party of the. Representing the party of the toffs. I mean, that was, you know, that was very, it was very, because that's a big negative for the Conservatives. They haven't really ever got rid of that taint.
You could tell that was in his mind.
And that was in his mind all the way through. I mean, there were two or three obvious themes to it. You know, one was our competence versus your chaos. I mean, that ran through it right from the start. You know, we've cleared up your mess. I mean, he says this in almost every budget in order to
for 5 years he's been saying
for
this,
five
but
years,
it still works.
But, you know, and in some ways, you know, it still works for him, even though he's made his own U-turns, he's had his own deviations from policy. Policy has failed in some ways.
I mean, that's the big thing, isn't it? That in a way, all this stuff, you can forget that it's a backdrop, is huge failure.
Yeah.
I mean, he was saying in 2010, we're going to have paid off the whole deficit by the lifetime of this parliament. His plan was to go into this election saying, we've cleared it up completely.
So this is plan B. I mean, plan B is the job's only half done. But the reality is that the deficit reduction and the pain that was supposed to be over in 5 years, now going to take 10 years or 8 or 9 years is actually going to be, you know, he's actually made some wiggle room to actually increase public spending right at the end of the next parliament. But essentially, what was supposed to be a sort of one parliament deal, you know, one act play, has turned into a two act play. And the second act is going to be pretty grim.
Pretty painful. The thing as well is that, oddly, that doesn't necessarily harm them politically, does it? Because he can then frame this election in a way, that time-honoured way, which is, we're on the right track, don't turn back.
Yeah.
You know, let us finish the job. That is in some ways, electorally, quite a clear message, whereas if they had cleared up the mess and done the job, in some ways you could have said, well, let's prepare for a Labour government to come in
We can afford a Labour government.
We can afford a Labour government.
It's obviously trying to avoid that at all costs. I mean, and you can see, you know, in this budget, the broad outlines of the Conservative election campaign, which starts right here. I mean, long after people have forgotten the individual measures, they'll remember one or two things, possibly like the help to buy for, you know, help to buy ISAs, and they might, you know, the tax increase, the increase in the tax allowance. But what they will pick up is the general thrust of his argument, which is that we are sorting out Labour's mess. Yeah,
and don't wreck it.
Don't wreck it.
And the sun is beginning to shine again. I mean, it was striking how many one-liners and sort of sound bites he had. It was almost, if this one doesn't work, try this one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the comeback country, sun is shining again, we're walking tall again. But it was emphasising the same thing over and over again. Yeah. Does it, you know, on the one hand, he wants to be all austere and sensible and say, we're not doing giveaways, we're not doing gimmicks. And yet, actually, putting $3,000 into your ISA, if you can, you know, you've got a 16-year-old and you've got 12 grand knocking around the house in this right to buy. So how is that not a giveaway and a gimmick, that proposal?
Well, it is a bit of a giveaway and it is a bit of a gimmick. I mean, it won't do anything to solve the problems of the housing market. I mean, the housing problem in the UK is that we don't have enough houses. I mean, the demand far exceeds supply, which is why house prices
so high
and continue to go up. You know, that's all our problem. And everything Osborne's done the last few years has added to that problem. I mean, Help to Buy itself was a contributory factor to that. So he's actually fueling the fire. So there will be a short-term boost to the housing market, and it will help a certain group of people in Britain. But there will be, you know, they are target Conservative voters. You know, quite rich people, most of whom will live in the southeast of England. A lot of whom will live in marginal seats. The fact is that this election will turn on perhaps 1,000 voters in 50 or 100 seats, maybe. So he's, you know, that was carefully calibrated. And I think that's a very questionable policy economically, and it may have long-term implications. I mean, everything the Bank of England has been doing for the last six to nine months has been trying to hose down the housing market, and this pushes it in the other direction. But that's why this was quite a nakedly political budget, even though it wasn't an overall, it wasn't a classic, here's a big load of money and let's increase borrowing in order to fund some tax cuts. He didn't do that, but it was still a very carefully calibrated political budget.
Larry Elliott and Jonathan Friedland there. Well, this morning I've been at the now traditional post-budget breakfast at the Resolution Foundation, a think tank in central London. One of the topics for discussion was yesterday's argument in the House of Commons about whether living standards were up or down with the coalition. I put the question to its director, Gavin Kelly.
There was a big claim made yesterday that they're up over the Parliament. Unfortunately, the answer is it all depends. There is a measure under which George Osborne can claim that living standards have risen. It's an official ONS measure, and on that basis, he is correct. We think it's a slightly flawed measure, however. It includes things in the measure of income that most families wouldn't recognise, like the implied level of their rent, which is quite a confusing thing for people who own their own houses. They probably don't think that they're getting better off if their house value's gone up a bit. So there's questions about the measure that he relied upon. There are other measures that we prefer to use, and using them, we think that living standards are probably slightly below where they were at the start of the Parliament, but again, you can get different types of answer depending on whether you use the mean or the median or various formulations. So it all depends. If you want to say no, there's a basis to say no. Things are still worse than they were in 2010. If you want to make the case that they're higher, as the George Osborne does, then there is one measure he can point to which gives him that answer.
So lies and damn lies and statistics. But isn't the thing for many voters going to be, it doesn't matter who was in power in 2010, but when the big squeeze started, whenever that was, 2009 or something, can we say that things are still worse than they were then?
Things, generally speaking, are worse than they were pre-crisis, which is probably a more natural benchmark, actually, for many kind of people who think about their family's plight and their family's budget over time. It's also the case, to state the obvious in a way, that all these numbers are national aggregates, and the experience of people in different regions, different sorts of households or different sorts of ages are radically different. So some households are massively worse off than they were, whether it's at the start of the crisis or in 2010. Some households households, you know, if you look at on average the retired households, are significantly better off. So these kind of national statistics, which give you a better off, worse off, simple answer, are just not going to relate to a large swathe of the country either way.
And one of the functions of the budget, of course, is to decide a bit of who gets and who gives a bit more. What have you got to say about the measures that were on tax and other things in terms of who gained from them?
First of all, there weren't that many big measures, I think, in this budget, possibly to some people's surprise. One of the headlines announcements was on the personal tax allowance, often billed as a tax cut for low earners. We've done a lot of work on this. It isn't really much of a tax cut for low earners. The lowest earning 5 to 6 million people in this country will gain not one penny from that tax cut yesterday. It is a broadly shared tax cut across the whole distribution, but on balance, it benefits the top half of the income distribution significantly more than the bottom half. So it's not how we would have spent that money.
Finally, we've got a lot of noise now and a lot of flavours of austerity going into the election, everyone promising they're going to be very responsible. A lot of people listening might think that means there's not all that much to choose between the parties. Would you agree with that or challenge it?
I completely challenge that. I think there's a very large gap between the parties. As of what happened yesterday, the gap got a little bit smaller, so it's gone from a very, very large gap to just a pretty big gap. But it is a big gap still, and there is a real choice on offer at this election in terms of the different fiscal positions of the main political parties.
Which is?
Significantly faster cuts, deeper cuts under a Conservative-led administration than under a Labour one, which would cut significantly less, and indeed actually might not even have to cut very much at all in real terms, but would be running a higher level of debt over the Parliament, and that is a real political choice.
A choice they haven't been all that upfront in talking about.
No, they've been relatively reluctant to sort of talk bluntly about that, and that's because I guess they think it may not play that well with some of the people they need to appeal to.
Gavin Kelly there. Well, I also ran into Robert Choate, the head of the Office for Budget Responsibility. That's the man who checks all the numbers to make sure that the Chancellor isn't cooking the books. He's done 13 of these fiscal events now, and the first question I asked him is, in the scale of things, was yesterday a big or a small budget?
Big and small in different ways. I think if you look at what had changed with the economy, quite a lot had gone on, but going in both directions. So a boost from lower oil prices, but more disappointment on growth and productivity, for example. On the public finances, a weaker outlook for both receipts and spending. Not a great deal going on in terms of the net giveaways and takeaways in the measures that were announced by the Chancellor. The biggest change, in fact, the sort of assumptions that were being penciled in about public spending over the course of the next Parliament, and in particular, of course, this decision to take away the additional cut in public spending as a share of GDP in 2019-20 that they'd penciled in back at the autumn statement.
And this is, I think, what you'd call the roller coaster, where we have the cuts and cuts and cuts, and then we have an increase at the end of the Parliament. How realistic is it that would happen? And does it mean, as some people are saying, that austerity would finish 1 year earlier than we thought?
Well, if you go back to the autumn statements, that was the first time that we'd moved our forecast on to 2019-20. And we needed the government to give us a statement as to, in effect, what its policy was towards public spending in that year. And at the time, they chose to say, well, we think there's going to need to be another cut in spending as a share of national income. And that, basically, they've decided is no longer the case. So on that definition, as you say, it would mean austerity comes to end a year earlier. So the roller coaster is really looking at what the implications of the overall policy they've given us for public spending is for day-to-day spending on public services, given what we think they're going to have to spend on other things. And there, as you say, the pattern is that you have a tighter squeeze in 2016 and 2017 than we've seen over the Parliament that's just coming to an end, and then it going into reverse with money being handed back in 2019-20. And you can see some of the logic for that in the other things that the government was trying to achieve. They didn't want to see total public spending going to a post-war low at the end of the forecast. They still wanted to achieve their new fiscal target with room to spare in 2017-18. The key point to bear in mind, though, this is what the government calls a fiscal assumption. The coalition has had to agree something for the purposes of this budget. They're both simultaneously explaining that they would do different things if they were governing alone. So if you were a government department and looking at this rather interesting profile for potential spending over the next parliament, there's a lot that could change. When a new government comes in, it may put different priorities on where it wants to be at the middle and the end of the forecast, and that could mean a different pattern for public services spending.
So the thing that changed yesterday is that they changed their mind rather than anything particularly in economics on when austerity ended. But I wonder, what are your thoughts if you were running a public service, a police station or something, and trying to think about what reforms you might do? Would it worry you that you're going to have to cut and cut and cut and then increase rather than having something steadier?
I don't think it's the sort of thing that anybody planning a public service would think as the most ideal path. I think, as I say, the point is that this is, at this stage, an assumption that the coalition has had to agree for the purposes of this budget and as a baseline against which each of them can explain the sort of things they would do differently. So the Conservatives talking about not needing to have as dramatic a squeeze in the early years because they'd find more money from welfare, more money from tax avoidance, etc., and the Liberal Democrats with a different path as well. So I think for people in public services, they are going to have to be patient and wait to see who is in government afterwards, and then they will have to sit down and say, let's produce a long-term path for public spending, planning, with that at the forefront of their mind, rather than ticking particular boxes in terms of how they want the public finances forecast to look in a particular budget.
Perhaps the biggest cheer in the House of Commons chamber was when George Osborne announced that he was actually going to hit a target that he himself had given up on very recently, the idea that debt would be falling this coming financial year. But I think the small print says that he's achieved that by selling off some assets. Is that a bit like selling a house that you own to go back to renting in order to pay down your overdraft?
Yes, I mean, the way in which the government gets back to a position of having net debt falling as a share of GDP next year is essentially announcing $20 billion of new financial asset sales next year. So some more shares in the Lloyds Banking Group and basically a vehicle for a bundle of mortgages that used to be owned by Northern Rock. Now, the key thing to remember about asset sales is that, you know, if you sell something for the value of the money that it would have brought into you in future years anyway, that's not actually leaving the public finances fundamentally better off. You're getting money today at the cost of money in the future. And indeed, if you look at the details of our forecast, the government can bring in £20 billion to reduce debt next year, but that actually means there's a flow cost of £10 billion over the remainder of the forecast. So it is a way, they've been transparent about it in a sense that this is how they've achieved that, and it is the asset sales that have made the difference.
Thank you for all of that. And can I just finally ask you, in terms of there's an election coming up, you've been doing this for 5 years, are you going to keep doing it, do you think, in the next parliament?
Well, that's not my decision to take. My term formally comes up to end in October of this year. I'd be very happy to carry on for a bit if people would like me to do that, but that's going to be an issue for whoever is in government once they've got through the rather more important items of the to-do list.
The OBR's Robert Choate. Well, before we go, there's just time to tell you about a new podcast series we've launched here at The Guardian. It takes you behind the scenes of our environment campaign, Keep It in the Ground. Here's a taste.
This is the biggest story in the world.
We will look back on these times and we will think, what on earth were we doing?
From The Guardian.
This is a story about people, and this is a story about possibility.
It's a story that's eluded us for decades. A topic which The Guardian is now throwing itself wholeheartedly into.
I'd seen how we'd done it on other things.
Climate change. So we're letting you in behind the scenes. Editorial meetings, bids for commissions. You'll hear what works, as well as our mistakes. And along the way, you can judge how we do. Is there a new way to make the world care? The biggest story in the world on The Guardian.
Well, that's all from me this week, but check back in to the Politics Weekly feed to find an exclusive interview with the Liberal Democrat leader, Nick Clegg. That's going to be available on Friday. My thanks to Larry Elliott, to Jonathan Friedland, Gavin Kelly and Robert Choate. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.